This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. 30 years ago, Chapel Hill Town Council member Joe Herzenberg made history when he became the first openly gay elected official in the South. Today, there are 13 out LGBTQ officials in the state of North Carolina. The social and political climate in the state has evolved dramatically in the past 3 decades. But many argue the heated debate around House Bill 2 and its replacement show that issues around sexuality and gender are still politically divisive. A group of current and former LGBTQ elected officials will gather at UNC Chapel Hill today to talk about their experiences. Three of them join me in the studio today. Later, we're going to be talking with Representative Deb Butler from Wilmington. Right now, Reverend Jasmine Beach Ferrara is with me, Commissioner of Buncombe County and founding executive director of the Campaign for Southern Equality. Jasmine, welcome back to the State of Things.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Also with me is Mark Kleinschmidt, a lawyer who served 6 years as the mayor of Chapel Hill. Mark, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Frank. I'm glad to be here.
Let me start with you. We talked about Chapel Hill Town Council member Joe Herzenberg, and I know he was an important influence on you and your decision to enter politics. Tell us about that.
Yes, he certainly was. I was 17 years old. I grew up in the military. We were stationed in Goldsboro at Seymour Johnson, and I was a closeted high school student, and WRAL News proclaimed the election of Joe Herzenberg in 1987 to the Chapel Hill Town Council. He had been appointed before that, but it was the first time anyone in the South who was open about their sexuality was actually elected to office. And it was in that moment that I realized that community was going to be my home one day. And, of course, I did attend UNC and quickly found a way to make Joe my friend. And I'm blessed to this day that he served as a mentor and a guide for me as I look to try to influence our communities in the way that he has.
What you first ran for office in 2009, what was it like for you to run as openly gay for that position?
Well, actually, the first time I ran was 2001 for council, and it was for the seat that Joe had. And he had left office several years before, but Chapel Hill was a community at the time that I think had some discomfort with the fact that its council wasn't as diverse as the community was. And when a qualified person put his name in the ring, and they were eager to support him, and I was very grateful for the trust that the community provided me, and after eight years on the council, even more grateful for the trust that they gave me when I became mayor in 2009.
You talked about that eagerness to diversify. There was a candidate who ran against you who was at least thought that in his case it might be to his advantage to put a spotlight on your sexuality.
Yes, in 2009 during my race, it was a very tight first race I had for council, and there were four folks running, and one of the candidates who ultimately got single-digit votes, so this, I'm not talking about any viable candidate, but there was one single-digit vote-getter who believed it was important to share with the community that I was openly gay and that I was an activist on the issue. He created a chart with points, including openly gay, activist, with names along the top, and put a yes next to me and a no next to himself, and he believed that was going to help him out. I think it actually did help voters understand who the candidates were, and ultimately probably helped me succeed in that race.
In Chapel Hill, of course. Well, Jasmine, you grew up in North Carolina and came out at a time when people weren't openly talking about, and you've been on this program talking about your journey and how difficult all that was for you. You left and were pretty much decided you were not coming back, right?
It wasn't quite that black and white, but I definitely left. I went away for college, but I did grow up as Joe was on council and watching Mark's involvement in early Chapel Hill politics. So those were definitely things that kept the idea of coming back home to the South in the mix for me, and I did.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the point. I mean, I think you're making it, Mark, and we're going to amplify this. There's the South, but there's not this South. There's Chapel Hill, there's Wilmington, there's, Buncombe County and Asheville and Durham, and then there's the South. And these are not all the same place, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are pockets of the South where it's a very different kind of conversation when an LGBT person announces a run for office, and where it can be seen as a strength in the local political community. The fact remains, though, that LGBT people do live in every single town, not just the right. Chapel Hills and Asheville's and Wilmington. So I think to some extent, I absolutely think that's an important line to pursue. But, you know, especially given the moment we're in our country, also always eager to be talking about what's it like to be an LGBT person living in rural Buncombe County.
Well, we're and yeah. What I was pointing to was the resistance, which tends to be greater in those areas mm-hmm. outside the urban areas. You launched the an organization called the Campaign for Southern Equality in 2011. It's a nonprofit that supports LGBTQ individuals in the South. Tell us more about that organization. And
absolutely.
What you're trying to
achieve. We're based in Asheville, North Carolina, and we have the great honor of working across North Carolina, but also across the entire South from Mississippi on up. Doing a mix of impact litigation and organizing to combat discriminatory laws, direct services. We do a lot of free legal clinics, and we also increasingly are doing funding and training to support grassroots organizers on the front lines of especially rural communities and small towns.
So you ran for office last year and became the first openly gay Buncombe County commissioner. Tell us why you decided to run.
It was really, I'm guessing, very similar to what's motivated Mark and Deb, an extension of wanting to be of service. An extension of wanting to engage on policy issues and really understanding in a firsthand way what happens when policy is used as a weapon to target people and the great power of what happens when policy is used to help lift people up. And it was also about wanting to increase visibility and representation for our community as part of a much broader project of diversifying North Carolina politics.
You became very active, obviously, in the debate over Amendment 1, both in the debate over that amendment and then in its aftermath, helping people through. Tell us a little bit about that and how that shaped your understanding of, you know, sort of how to tackle these issues in the South.
Well, we worked to fight Amendment 1 from the moment it surfaced. And as with so many civil rights battles, it required using every tool in our toolkit to do that. So that involved lobbying at the legislature when it was still at the legislative level. We coordinated a campaign of direct action and civil disobedience where same-sex couples across North Carolina were requesting and being denied marriage licenses to kind of tell a new story about this, especially in smaller towns. And then we also had the great honor to work with Mark and a team of attorneys who challenged Amendment 1 in federal court on both First and 14th Amendment grounds through the case that actually ended up striking it down. And I think some of the lessons drawn from that, I think, very much apply to HB2 right now in terms of us needing to be both agnostic and creative and nimble about using many tools and strategies at once to challenge these laws when they were coming down the pipeline.
Tell us a little bit more about one of those tools that you used, and you just made reference to it, which was sort of encountering clerks who would then, after the amendment passed. Tell us about that strategy and what you learned.
Well, the whole thrust of that strategy was about changing the story. The story used to be, if you're LGBT and you're from a small town in the South, you run away as fast as you can. But the reality is that people live and stay in their hometowns and are proud to do so and sometimes don't necessarily have the option to leave. What we wanted to do was situate this story in the town where people lived, on the streets of their downtown, at their local Register of Deeds office, and have this direct exchange at the counter at the Register of Deeds office where not just an anonymous couple and an abstract law were being talked about, but real people who'd been together for decades in some cases, standing across from someone and who was in many cases a neighbor or an acquaintance. And a critical piece of that for us was always coming from a place of empathy. The tempting, easy thing to do can be to condemn the clerk in that moment, to make it about them. And what we tried to do was sort of change the vector of that story and say what discriminatory laws do is entangle all of us in the system of persecution. You on your side of the counter, us on our side of the counter. And if we're to transcend this, it's going to be because we can see each other's humanity and start to make some different choices rather than just sheer, simple, silent compliance.
And again, comes from a place of understanding that LGBTQ individuals live in all those communities. Everybody in those communities knows them. Often they understand who they are in their community. And when it becomes personal, it's not some issue that somebody from Raleigh can stir you up about. This is about somebody I know.
Someone I know, and in many cases, someone I love. Exactly. And I think part of our work moving forward needs to continue to be about that relational piece.
And Mark, there were obviously this very personal approach, and now we're still talking about Amendment 1 at the moment. You were vocal about not wanting to encourage boycotts against the state after it had passed Amendment 1. Tell us about that decision.
Yeah, that's right. I participated enthusiastically in the fight against Amendment 1, and I remember moving across the state, talking to folks, appealing to their hearts, their minds, in the ways that Jasmine was doing with the campaign for Southern Equality. And I witnessed in each of these individuals, gay and straight, this love of their state, the love of their community, and the offense which this amendment was, and how that offense was impacting their lives. After it passed, I did an evaluation, an analysis of where these votes were coming from. And I discovered in that analysis that no votes were coming from every county in North Carolina. They were largely concentrated in almost every urban area, every city, from places as rural as Dare County, mm-hmm. all the way out into the west, beyond Asheville.
That is votes against. When you say votes, you mean there were votes against coming
against
from
every county. Yeah, against the amendment. And these were extraordinary folks who were standing up against the oppression of that amendment. And I didn't believe they needed to be punished for the work they did. I authored a Huffington Post piece to make sure that folks around the country knew about Dare County, that knew about Asheville, that knew about the city of Winston-Salem, even if they didn't want to visit the county. There were folks who were ready, willing, and to welcome everyone in their community.
Go from Amendment 1 to HB 2 and on up to 142 as our conversation continues with former Chapel Hill Mayor Mark Kleinschmidt, Buncombe County Commissioner Jasmine Beach Ferrara, and joining our conversation in just a moment, Deb Butler, state representative from Wilmington, all on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today with current and former out LGBTQ elected officials in North Carolina. Still with us, former Chapel Hill Mayor Mark Kleinschmidt, Buncombe County Commissioner Jasmine Beach Ferrara, joined now by Deb Butler, a Wilmington-based attorney who was appointed earlier this year to fill the House seat vacated by Susie Hamilton. She is one of three openly gay LGBTQ members in the state's General Assembly. Deb Butler, welcome to you.
Well, thank you.
You are new to the General Assembly, but your family goes way back. Tell us a bit about your background.
Yeah, well, let's see. My dad was a furniture executive, and we lived at every stop on Interstate 40 from the mountains to the coast, pretty much, and on into East Tennessee. So a suburb of Lincolnton called Boger City is where I spent my formative years. So I'm no stranger to rural, small-town North Carolina.
You are among the many people who left and came back. You were an attorney in New York City for a while.
Yes, I decided that when I graduated from Wake Forest Law School, curiously, I had an interview in Wilmington, and the salary offered was substantially less than a school teacher made in those days, and I took that personally and fled to New York where I could actually earn a living. So,
what brought you back?
Well, it might have been those series of winters, Frank, that where I was walking to yeah. court in hip-deep snow. Mm-hmm. That might have done it. And I guess a desire to be home is common among most folks. I mean, North Carolina has a lot to recommend. In spite of the difficult components of the political landscape, it's a welcoming, wonderful place to live. So,
you ran for county commissioner in 2010, then for the state senate in 2012. Tell us about running as an out elected official by that time.
Well, my political timing has been horrendous from start to finish, pretty much. 2010 was when Amendment 1 found its way to the ballot. And so it was in that political climate which I decided it was a good time to launch my career. So my timing hasn't been great. But, you know, you get there when you're supposed to be there, I think. So that was 2010. I ran for the county commission and won the primary as an out person very handily. But then the Tea Party tsunami ensued, and we elected two Republicans to our county commission. So I was not the trailblazer in that community. We had a former state senator named Julia Bozeman who actually pulled the laboring oar on that, if you will. And so our community had elected her handily in a couple of instances. And I didn't see that as a as a, an impediment.
When you talk about a tsunami, and I think about the cross currents, I think about the waves coming in and the undertow that's all part of that dynamic. So what about the fact that you were able to run and win by then in Wilmington, and how would that have been different or even possible, say, 10 years earlier, do you think?
Yeah, I really don't know. The population, certainly in Wilmington, as in all of North Carolina, is changing pretty dramatically. Yeah. Our city has grown exponentially. We do have a very diverse community. People have moved from all walks of life, retired there. People moved from other more progressive places to our inner city. And so I don't know. We are a true bellwether in that sense. We have one-third Democratic population, one-third independent population, and one-third Republican population. And so goes New Hanover County, as goes most of the state, typically.
So talking about your timing, you enter the legislature. HB 2 had been passed. The debate over what to do about that thing was robust at the moment that you found yourself there. Tell us about your response to HB 2 and then your priorities as you entered during this debate.
Well, it's certainly an historic time for me to be there. And as I evaluated whether I wanted to put my name in the running to fill Susie Hamilton's House District 18 seat, I stood back and I thought about the dynamics of what was going on in Raleigh and just how important it would be to have an LGBT voice. It was just, upon reflection, a no-brainer for me that I should have that voice in the mix, and that if I could contribute, that it was imperative that I do that.
What's your sense about this HB 142, the replacement bill?
Well, I didn't vote for that, Frank. I did not think it – well, it doesn't extend protections to LGBT citizens, for starters. And that on its face was enough for me to not vote for it. Now, I will say this. I had a front row seat to watch the inner workings of the Democratic caucus. I had two visits, personal visits from the governor. I saw the angst and the anxiety and the apprehension that Democratic caucus struggled with. And those members who voted in the affirmative for it did so grudgingly. I know that firsthand. Many of them have come up to me and apologized, if you will, for their vote, but they felt compelled to support their Democratic governor. Now, again, I could not vote for it because I just felt like it fell short of doing what needed to be done, and I felt like we have the moral high ground on this issue. So, again, we will see how the dust settles on this decision. We don't really understand. Well, we know that there are still going to be boycotts. We know that there are people who have imposed travel bans. New York and Boston have declined to, you know, send their state employees this way. So it's not over yet. And so we'll see.
Mark, how do you feel about 142?
Well, I think it's I'm not pleased with it. I think we're at a moment in time where we can shift from just merely playing defense. And our response to HB 2 is an opportunity to actually move the ball forward rather than just hold it in our court. You know, we've gone over the last 30 years of just trying to get somebody at the table. We battled against sodomy laws. We battled for marriage equality and adoption, and we need to keep moving forward lest we fall backwards. And, you know, I'm so honored to have Deb there and her other LGBT out colleagues to speak that truth to their caucus and to the legislature at large, because this is not a time for stepping back. I mean, you know, the folks talk about how long the arc of justice is in the way it's supposed to be bending. But, you know, it doesn't bend itself.
Right.
We need some folks like Deb in the legislature pulling it towards justice. And this is the time for all of us, I believe, to grab hold and bend.
What about you, Jasmine? What's your sense of 142?
Very similar. I think it's a really terribly disappointing outcome at this point, and I don't think the story's over. You know, I think a central tenet of for elected officials is when a law targets a community, start by asking that community what they think. And again, it's incredible that we have out LGBT officials at the General Assembly who did just that. But every single person I know in the community has been outraged by this bill. And it's just felt like it throws our community under the bus, to be blunt about it, and that the way forward on civil rights has never proven to be incrementalism or this kind of crouching posture of accommodation. There are many things we can compromise about in North Carolina and that we need to and that we do every day, and I think that's an important principle. But another principle in governance has to be fighting for the equal protection of every person under the law. And this has created new barriers to equal protection for LGBTQ North Carolinians.
But as a practical matter, is it always an even arc and is it always straightforward? Because there are those who would argue that the battle for civil rights and any minority struggle has always been in fits and starts with reversals.
Functionally and in the real politic, definitively, it's jagged, it's often unpredictable, it's chaotic. But from the perspective of advocates, people for whom this is about your life, not about politics, and elected officials who campaign on pledges to bring that perspective into their decision making, I think the arc that Mark's describing and the way we have to put our shoulder to the wheel of that arc is exactly the path forward.
And Mark, you had a very different approach to sanctions against North Carolina when it came to HB2 mm-hmm. than you did for Amendment 1. We talked about that earlier. Talk about how you felt, you know, what should have been the public response and corporate response to HB2 and why you were somewhat different on HB2 than you were Amendment 1.
Well, and there's a huge contrast in the way that they became the public policy of North Carolina. You know, we had Amendment 1, in contrast, had the activist power of citizens who were, who are laying out a welcome mat and demonstrating the best of who we are as North Carolinians. HB2 was a politically motivated piece of legislation passed by a handful of North Carolinians who happened to be elected to the General Assembly. And the language that you speak to those folks is a little different, I believe, than you do to the larger community of North Carolina citizens. And you have to speak a language that they're going to listen to. And that means impacting the other things that they claim are important, like the economy. And so I was pleased when entertainers took the lead and then when athletic organizations followed suit and businesses got on board with their protest against HB2 and their the decisions they made to not invest in our community until change was made. And, I would hope that people of goodwill who continue to work in those industries will consider HB 142 mm-hmm. and its impact on the actual struggle that we're engaged in here.
Well, Deb Butler, let me ask you. We've talked about the impact of and I think we make an assumption that if you pave the way for out LGBTQ individuals to take power and to be elected to public office, things will change. But then we're also marking this jagged course, right? I mean, 25 years after Joe is elected and is the first out LGBT representative in the South, then we see Amendment 1 and then we see HB2. So what kind of a path are we on? Do you feel that it's made a difference to have out members of your community in public office?
Well, I absolutely do. There's no question about that. I mean, I would echo what Jasmine said in the sense that, had the LGBT community been consulted more seriously as the repeal bill was put together, I think you would have, number one, gotten a better result, and secondly, people wouldn't feel so aggrieved by what transpired. And I said on the floor of the House that day when we were debating the bill that, my community would rather suffer HB2, and if we are suffering HB2, that is our cross to bear, and we would rather suffer HB2 forever rather than have this body tell us one more time that we are not equal under the law. So I made that plea, and I think it fell on a lot of compassionate ears, but they were mostly on the Democratic mm-hmm. side of the room. I'm quick to say, however, that being in the room and working every day with those folks who are not on my side of the aisle is making a difference, too. Believe it or not, I have made good Republican friends there already, and that's part of the process of changing minds and hearts along the way.
How would you feel about that, Mark, and the impact of the changes that have taken place over time and the fact that LGBTQ members are open and in positions of power? Has it mattered much?
I think it's been critical to the the growth of the growth of our state in relation to the rest of the country. I mean, it was we had to prove our mettle on this issue over the last 30 years, and I think that the state generally has done a fair job in being able to try to hopefully secure its place as the continued beacon of progress in the South. But you know, the progress we have made over these decades don't come without newly minted challenges that opponents are going to be throwing at us. We should not have been surprised that Amendment 1 came in 2010. We shouldn't be surprised about HB 2. And we should expect further obstacles. But the work that we've done over the last 30 years has steeled our community, number one, made us more effective, has developed leadership within our community, has given us opportunity to have well-crafted and well-argued voices. But we've also created allies. We've opened doors. We've opened windows in some stuffy rooms where they didn't know the LGBT people existed. I mean, when Deb talks about the ability to now have positive relationships, strong relationships with the other side of the aisle, that presence is hugely significant because Deb brings more than just her LGBT status to that conversation. When she walks into that room and she can charm with her smile some crotchety old 30-year-old veteran of the North Carolina House and convince that gentleman of her views on environmental protection, on racial equality, as well as LGBT equality. I mean, all of our lives are enhanced. And that's what participation of the LGBT community in positions of leadership has done for North Carolina. It's actually improved the health and welfare and safety of every North Carolinian. And that's true when you talk about any minority group. And that's why diversity at the decision-making table is so important.
Jasmine, how do you feel about that?
Absolutely. I think it's critical. And, you know, in addition to those motivations, it's also about making sure kids who are growing up right now, whose reality is that HB2 just passed a year ago, that they're also seeing a reality where North Carolina is electing folks like Deb at the state level and electing folks at the local level. You know, I think that ricochets in people's lives in very powerful ways. I know it did in my own growing up in Chapel Hill while Joe was elected, for instance. And I think, you know, I can't stress enough that, as Mark said, you know, this is about the journey of LGBT people and other minority communities that have been on the margins and targeted by discriminatory laws into full participation in every aspect of American life.
Deb, you have made the point, too, that it's not just in the chamber that you might have an influence, but the fact that this debate has gone on has begun to change minds, that we've talked about this in public for a long time, and you can see changes in the polls now that it's an issue that people are more familiar with.
You know, I sort of analogize it, Frank, to trying a new food. And the first time you take a bite of something you've never had before, it's often distasteful. And I'm told by scientists it takes about 3 or 4 bites of that food for the brain to develop a kinship to it. I mean, again, issues that are difficult and complex and new take a few passes. It takes information for it to begin to resonate. And so I think that particularly with the issue of transgenderism, I mean, this is a difficult issue for some people. But with information and exposure and more information and more exposure, it gets easier with every pass. And I think that's where we'll see transformative change on these issues.
What are the biggest obstacles going forward?
You know, again, we have a setback with HB2. You know, again, it's one step forward. Sometimes it feels like 2 steps back. But this has focused the conversation on this issue. We weren't talking about transgender men and women 2 years ago, thanks to former Governor Pat McCrory, we are now. So, again, maybe this is the first pass of information, and there will be more passes of information. And people will begin to recognize transgender men and women in their community. They will develop relationships with these people, and we will see effective change that way. And, again, we've got terrific allies in Equality North Carolina and the Human Rights Campaign, and those folks have pushed the issue forward and are largely responsible for informing our community. And for them to do that is a big bonus for all of us.
Mark, biggest obstacles moving forward?
Well, I believe that, you know, there's a there's a set of issues that many North Carolinians have problems with because they're identified with growing urban centers in North Carolina. And there's a fear in rural and agrarian North Carolina that they're losing, that the identity of the state as they know it, you know, part of the agrarian South is being lost in some way. And so issues like this that are novel to many folks, as Deb mentioned, these are conversations we weren't having a few years ago, that they often reflexively just dismiss them as urban interests. And they wonder, why aren't we working on issues that affect all of us, like the economy? You know, the population of the county I grew up in, is in Wayne County, is diminishing. You know, they're losing the economic their prior economic power. There aren't jobs for kids when they graduate from high school, and they're fleeing. And folks in Goldsboro wondering, and in Kinston are wondering, why are we talking about these issues, which to them are brand new? They'd never heard anything about them, and we're not dealing with these fundamental economic disparities. And so I think one of our biggest obstacles is connecting on the LGBT front, is connecting our experience with theirs and helping remind them that we're everywhere, that this isn't an urban issue. This is an issue that's on Center Street in Goldsboro as much as it is on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill, and that we can actually all pull together on this one.
Jasmine, I've left you 20 seconds for the biggest obstacle.
The biggest obstacle zooms us out of North Carolina onto a national stage, which is that the South has been the laboratory for the latest generation of anti-LGBT laws, like HB2 and also religious exemption laws, that we're now seeing mirrored in drafted federal legislation, the First Amendment Defense Act, and a drafted executive order from the Trump administration. So I think the biggest threat on the horizon is the potential proposal of those on the federal level.
Jasmine Beach-Ferrara, commissioner at Buncombe County, also talked to Deb Butler, represents the state's 18th district, which includes Wilmington and the North Carolina General Assembly. Mark Kleinschmidt, a lawyer who served 6 years as mayor of Chapel Hill. Thank all of you for being on the program.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Coming up, the music of Mountain Faith Band on the State of Things. Please stay with us.